All right, all right, all right. Welcome to a special episode of Digging a Hole. Ordinarily on Digging a Hole, my co-host Sam Moyne and I talk about legal theory and whatever else is on our minds. But today is a special episode. It's hopefully the first in a series. One of the great things about being a law professor is that you know a number of very smart people who know a lot about things that you are interested in or care about, especially things you don't know about yourself. And today is an episode where we're going to start asking a genuine expert to explain the news to us. Hopefully we'll be introducing these every now and again. And to say that Kate Klonick is an expert really understates the case. And to say that I am a fan of Kate Klonick dramatically understates the case. Kate teaches property internet law at St. John's University and is currently the a visiting scholar at Harvard University on rebooting Social Media Institute. But I know Kate as the world's expert on free speech and speech moderation on online social platforms. Her pieces on how the Facebook Oversight Board works, which are both scholarly and journalistic, at The New Yorker, and her work called The New Governors, are really, like, when I say that they've influenced me on this subject, it understates the case again. It's all I know about the subject. So, Kate, we thought we'd have Kate on, or I thought I'd have Kate on, because Sam's not here, to explain what's going on with Twitter. So, welcome, Kate.
Thank you so much. That was a generous introduction, but I appreciate it.
I even forgot to mention, Kate's a veteran podcaster from her recently ended but much beloved show In Lieu of Fun. So we all missed the show very much. So we're so glad we could have Kate on to talk about this. So I want to ask you some questions about Twitter. We're not going to talk about like the business mechanics, like why was Elon Musk eventually forced to buy the company when he didn't want to. But what drove Elon Musk's, it seems like his interest in Twitter was a question about content moderation. What's his beef?
Yeah. So, I mean, he is kind of has the same beef that a lot of people on the far right have, and that people who are generally skeptical of kind of conspiracy theorists around like kind of the liberal elite that are running these platforms and the content moderation that they're doing. This has obviously been something that's been fomenting since the 2016 US presidential election, and really has kind of, I would say, like, it is the reason that we talk about content moderation here. And there's like six content moderation journalists at the New York Times that have been hired in the last, you know, in the last 5 years, where there were none before. It's kind of an amazing, really huge growth. But his beef is essentially, it seems that he doesn't approve of kind of the way that the platform is being governed. It seemed that that was his initial interest. It's his stated interest what's going on with the platform.
Is his complaint that it's bad, that Twitter's content moderation is bad for the world or bad for Twitter as a business?
Oh.
Because you could imagine both, yes.
Oh, yeah. No, great. And so I think that one is like, it has nothing to do with business. I don't think that that is his, what draws him to, it's not his stated purpose anyways, but I also don't think it's like, it's actually has anything to do with, he wants to make Twitter a more profitable company. I think he is now going to try to make Twitter a more profitable company, because I think the only thing that, and they have this from like a number of people who used to work with him as his lawyers and other things at SpaceX and other places, were essentially that the only thing that he actually really feels bad about is losing other people's money. So I think that that is actually going.
And there's a lot of other people's money here.
It's like all, it's actually mostly other people's money. So I don't think he cares at all about like the actual governance of like how about like, I think it started off him not caring about the business side of the platform at all. His like having this mercurial emotional response of wanting to do better speech governance and then, or whatever he thinks is better speech governance. And then now he is like deep in it with like trying to figure out what this business model is going to be. It is like literally like watching someone in real time that hasn't taken like an internet startup's class at like a business school. Like these are just the way that we know revenue models work for these platforms of starting with advertisers and then switching to subscription models, all of this stuff that he's doing and just like messing around with and like now like asking Stephen King if he'd pay $8 instead of $20 like to keep his blue check mark is just, it's just mercury. It's just like nonsense. And so it's, I mean,
so can I back up one
second?
So Twitter's content moderation, obviously something we've talked a great deal about as a society. Like, should Donald Trump be kicked off Twitter? Should Milo, whatever his name is, be kicked off Twitter? What was Twitter's content moderation policy? And how is it different from, say, the other social platforms? Because Twitter was always a little bit, at least was in the past, like a little more Wild Westy than other platforms. So what made Twitter's content moderation different, special, or what, relative to, say, Facebook?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things, but I would say that it starts with the product and the privacy settings. So one of the things is, when I say it starts with the product, is it's primarily text-based. Twitter, of course, came up in kind of a day when you used to be able to, like, type out, like, send SMS to text, right? And that has always kind of been its bread and butter. It is very light. It doesn't have kind of, it's not like TikTok where it's serving you videos and, you know, it hasn't been around for as long. And of course, it's diversified a little bit. The second part is...
So it's why academics love it.
Right, exactly.
Academics and journalists, it's all words. We don't have to deal with like people being good looking or like cool. It's all just like nonsense text. Perfect.
It is, which is, I'm very sad that Scott Shapiro, like the world's greatest shit poster, can't be here today.
My God. Yeah. And Sam Moyne.
I know.
Both of them were our former partners are basically like the Twitter addicts and experts at the same time.
Yeah. It's actually like it's a remarkably rich medium. And like, but one of the other reasons that it makes it so rich and that academics love it and journalists love it is that it's mostly public. It operates mostly public and not in a walled garden that Facebook kind of operates in, right? Like you don't trust people on Facebook that you just don't know. You don't say things. So you share different types of information, or you don't, like you just kind of decide. And so this is one of the things that makes Twitter kind of unique. And this is also, so it's content moderate. You have to kind of have that valence in the back of your mind when you're thinking about how they decide to do content moderation. And it was also, I would say, there was this little bit of a social planner model in it. It was particularly run, and like the lawyers for Twitter early in the early days of the kind of wild, wild west internet saw it. If you remember, like there was the Arab Spring and a lot of other kind of moments in which the lightness of Twitter, the text-based kind of ability of Twitter, the ability for Twitter to connect people without constant internet service for protest or democratic functions was hugely kind of valued. And so there has been, but like I would say that around, people don't remember this, but around 2015, there had been Gamergate, there had been all of these very large harassment campaigns against women and people of color. There was the Leslie Jones controversy, which was probably one of the largest and most prolific. And Twitter really started to take content moderation seriously around 2015. And
so, by the way, yeah. I want to go back, stop one second there. Are we going to look back at Gamergate as the hinge of history? Like Gamergate is like basically like the central moment in understanding our new medium. It's like, it's the Gutenberg Bible of the internet.
No, I don't, you know, like there's been lots of these moments. We all have like goldfish brains. No one remembers like one thing to the other, but there's been a million things like Gamergate. I mean, it was one of the greatest, like actually the thing about Gamergate is how long it took to have an effect. Like it wasn't one moment. It was like 3 to 4 years of protest from feminist kind of bloggers and other types of things. And I mean, you know, and there have been a lot of scholars who have been like trying to highlight kind of these issues for a long time, and no one cared about them for years until it started being bad for business and bad for advertisers. And so I think that that's, you know, unfortunately not like the hinge,
but it is like an important chunk.
It's like an important chunk. I would say it's like the War of the Roses or something.
The basic story is like they start getting serious about this in 2015. And what do they do to get serious about it? And again, how it's just like if you could do like compare and contrast Facebook with this, because Facebook is going in a slightly different parallel tracks here.
Yeah. So they start to get serious about it. Twitter hires some new people to handle trust and safety, and they start really changing their kind of like hands-off approach. And they start relying more on kind of on algorithmic control of like what you're seeing in your newsfeed. They introduce a lot of new features, which are now very ubiquitous, but like they weren't there before. They introduced the mute button. They introduced the blocking function. I mean, they've had the blocking function, but the mute button was huge. And then they love mute.
I love to mute people.
I know.
So satisfying.
It is. It's like really, I think that there's, you know, there's a lot of, they introduced better mechanisms for safety of just like being able to report death threats, of being able to report certain types of things. I mean, that was some really bad content.
But didn't they also go in the other direction too? So like, when does the quote tweet button come? Because that's like, sometimes some people think of that as like the opposite of like creating the internet duck.
Yes. I mean, no,
the Twitter duck.
I don't actually know when the quote tweet button came. I think it's like been there for a while, though. That was like pre 2015.
Maybe it's earlier. Yeah.
Yeah, but,
okay,
but
wait, so there's some conflict here because they're doing things that are going in each direction.
Oh, yes. There is stuff that goes in each direction. And of course, they have this business model that they're trying to. But like what I would say is they're having the conversation more than they had the conversation before. And so this is like a back and forth. And, you know, and there's also, I will say, you know, one of the things that they were criticized for was trends and like how they were setting trends, because those would kind of start these flame wars or kind of like, you know, do, you know. And so there's lots of controversy around those types of things. Of course, controversy like going into the election in 2020 and after 2016. But I would just say that generally speaking, they start to roll out more features and the features create more diversity of the platform. There's more opportunities to find people. And then there's more opportunities, which is either good or bad for Twitter. This is always kind of the trade-off. Like you do more moderation, people get a little more siloed. Maybe they don't engage quite as much or they don't. But there's always like this kind of, there's always kind of this point at which at some point, if you don't moderate enough, people are exhausted by it and leave. And if you do moderate, if you moderate too much, it's not interesting or engaging. And so you just have to hit this sweet spot where people are seeing kind of what they want to see, but being challenged on the edges. And this is kind of this fascinating kind of part about how it's not really, once you have users, that's important, but you have to keep the users and keep them engaged, which is of course this ad model.
I have a question about that. Is the effort to moderate, like the aggressive efforts to moderate, or the more aggressive, the somewhat, whatever happened in 2020, is that driven by kind of what we think of as external political control or alternately at like kind of profit maximization is it that they're worried they're going to get regulated out of existence, or is it that they are face international whatever it is that's some kind of political risk, or is it just like people are going to be too annoyed to be on this website?
I think now. Yeah, so there's two answers to that question, like when they started versus when they started versus what it is now. And I think that now the justification is very much revenue based. I think that it's just very straight up, like this is how you make money in an advertising model. I just also want to point out how much it is taken for granted. Like we're talking about Musk not understanding like the basics of kind of like a business school level being able to do this type of thing. But I want to point out AOL didn't understand its own business model, which was a mix of subscription and like an advertising. And I really mean this.
They understood it very well. You sell it to someone rich before you go out, you get ready to make a shit ton of money.
Oh my gosh. But no. So like they actually thought this is like a fascinating kind of part of this. It's like when AOL and the time, I just did a huge historical deep dive back into like the FCC memos and all of the stuff that was coming out about this. But AOL, Time Warner merger, they thought that they were buying content. They thought that like the way to the future of the content wasn't user-generated content, wasn't networks of people, was going to be the cash cow of big content, which was like LA and all of these, you know. And so that's what they...
Sports Illustrated.
Exactly. And that's what they thought that they were getting. They did not understand that, like, what that if, like, that no one was going to keep paying a subscriber rate for their crappy platform. And that the biggest thing they didn't understand, they didn't understand that people were hanging out on their platform to talk to each other in chat rooms and in messaging. And when the FCC decided to make AIM, like AOL Instant Messenger, interoperable with ICQ and MSN Messenger and all of those things, and there were like open sources available, no one signed on to AOL ever again except to check their mail. Like, this is like, and like, and one and two, like, the, to tell you that I'm right about this, 2 years later, the one thing that AOL went back and begged the FCC to release them from like their initial merger agreement was the interoperability in like AIM.
Fascinating.
Yeah, like, no, anyway. Yeah, anyway, sorry, I like digress.
It's a great aside. So the question is like, that when Musk arrives on the scene with his complaint, it's, you could imagine his complaint of being, let's make the company more profitable by going back to this previous model where it was more fun, it was cooler, before they got like cowed by either by political risk or by elite capture. Like the Twitter people are just like part of, I don't know, elite circles, and therefore, and this way will be a better business. And another version of it is to say, you know, I'm just the richest guy in the world. I thought it was more fun. And sure, we're going to lose money, but who gives a shit?
Yeah.
So, like, that's the thing I don't quite understand about his rhetorical line, because it seems to, or does it mean to be both of these things, or what?
I think that you're giving him too much credit. I'm actually kind of, I think that, like, you're thinking that you're buying into the tech genius myth a little bit too much. I think that there were, like, I mean, and I just wrote a piece about this for The Information, but I think that this is, I think that it's like he can have both of those things. I think that he does have both of those things. I think that he is like, has like a lot of like intellectual incoherence, because I don't think he thinks through a lot of these thoughts. I mean, the classic thing, David, is like, he doesn't, like, everyone knows that that a public square has element, has like either through norms or like geography or like physical,
some kind of constraints,
constraints on it. Of course, like, everything is regulated, like either top down or like otherwise. You don't need time, place, manner restrictions. They help once you have boom boxes, right? Like, but there is like, but these are not. So I mean, like, this is the fundamental flaw in like, the fact that he doesn't understand that is like, I think going, I mean, he'll either learn, but it's like a little bit like sad that he's going to, I don't know if I can say the F word, but he's going to F around and find out. And it's like, we're like a little late.
There are literally no rules. You can, okay, you can, like, say fuck if you want.
He's going to fuck around and find out. It's like a pretty bad business strategy for a $44 billion company. And that's essentially what we're seeing. Like, and it's like, it's kind of crazy. Like, it is that,
I mean,
crazy.
This is a great story about a kind of related phenomenon that we could talk about, but I think, like, about the, like, what, like, vast high-end wealth inequality will do, not, like, socially necessarily, I mean, maybe also socially, but, like what happens when businesses don't have to be profit-maximizing, which I suppose is the story we say about like, Facebook also, right? Like, it's, like, it doesn't have to be profit-maximizing. But I want to go a little bit to, like, what's going to happen. And then I've got some, so let me do one more backing up question. So Kevin Rose, the New Yorker, yeah, New York Times writer, said the thing that, like, described the Musk purchase as the end of Twitter, as like the little guy beats the big guy. So the Twitter's like MO was, it was the mechanism through which you had unmediated content. It was like maybe the internet as the dream of the internet, the dream of the 90s or the dream of the early 2000s lives in Twitter. And that Musk purchase of it is the end of a culmination of a process that is the end of that kind of thing. Do you buy that story or not?
Yeah, I do, actually. I think that Kevin's like mostly correct about a lot of stuff. But in particular, I think that this was, I agree with that. I think that it's going to happen much slower than anyone thinks. I think all of this stuff happens actually slower, both faster and slower than anyone thinks. But there is, I think that like eventually, I don't think everyone's going to leave the platform. Network effects are very sticky. But I do think that like people will
use
it less.
My cold dead tweeting hands, Kate. My cold dead tweeting hands.
I mean, I'm setting up, like I said this to people, I'm like, I'm not like spending time on Mastodon, but I'm spending time building a presence on Mastodon and understanding it so that, like, you know, it's kind of, you know, there's...
Oh, sorry, hold on. Back up. Mastodon?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah,
what
sorry.
What is Mastodon?
Mastodon is kind of, is one of the, part of the Fediverse, as I said, which is kind of like these independent, and they don't kind of speak to each other. You can't you can't, they're not interoperable basically with kind of established networks like Twitter or Facebook. But they are alternatives to Twitter for social networking. They are very clunky. Someone just tweeted like that the alternative for Twitter is going to, why don't we just go and screw around with ham radios? Mastodon feels a little bit like a ham radio.
I'm ready for... I'm ready for email to come back. I'm excited for that. I want people to email and use the telephone. But then again, I'm old as hell.
So. Yeah. Like, what? Yeah. Just like,
I left someone a voice message the other day.
What is wrong with you? Why would you do that to them?
I mean, they were so angry. They sent me a list of expletives. I was like, they said, you know, the thing with the hashtag and the star. They're like, what's wrong with you, man? I was like, I just want to talk.
Yeah. You sound like my mom who like cuts things out of the newspaper and scans them. And then emails them to me. We're making progress. Yeah. She started taking photos of Dead Tree newspapers and texting them to me. But it's like that took 10 years.
I tweeted a photo of a Dead Tree newspaper the other day. It was I felt both historical and modern. All of this said, it's a Musk's complaint about Twitter seems to start with like a belief, not even that content moderation is bad, but just that it was being done badly. Like it's with the Babylon Bee, right?
Yeah.
It's like you guys should be cooler. And by cooler, you mean like liking the Babylon Bee. Like this is something else I don't understand, which is like, is his complaint, does he really think that, I mean, again, before he's forced to back up, I want to go through the story, but does he really, is the complaint like, I'd rather no constraints or weak constraints, or is it, I'd rather your constraints be more politically neutral or something? Like, is it like, you're bad to conservatives or you're just buzzkills? That's the thing I can't quite get.
Oh, okay. That's like, I don't know that it matters, but I do think that, and I'm like, I can't crawl, and I'm happily can't crawl inside the head of Elon Musk. But I will say that, like, I think that you have to, I don't know how many people you know that are kind of engineers in the model of I know a lot of people that are kind of like Elon Musk. And like, I would guess that this is the best, not in being a billionaire, but in like, That type of, and there's just like there is a desire to be a heterodox thinker. There is the desire to kind of thumb your nose at convention and like the group. I think that there is an idea that you can like figure it all out better yourself, and that you have a better way to do it. There's a lot of ego. I mean, like, I just think that this is.
But does it convey towards like we should ban or limit like left-wing scolds of right-wingers?
I mean, I don't know. That's the question. I don't think so. Yes. That would be incoherent. That would be super, super... I mean, but he is so mercurial that we just, like, have no idea.
Does he have a... shouldn't. Is there a person? Is there a...
He has an attorney. He has an attorney who's come over and is now going to be doing trust and safety. Kate Conger reported this in the New York Times. I think she broke it, but there is, I think his name is Spiros. He is like the thing about Musk is he goes
like
through,
the guy from Billions, Spiros, the lawyer from Billions.
Oh no, his last name is Spiros, but yeah, maybe. I mean, like kind of that's a really good, I think oh, wow. But anyways, yes, I think that essentially what there is a great Musk story that I heard that was essentially that he was having a meeting of lawyers at Tesla. And he goes, I hate all of you guys. You keep telling me what I can't do. And the only lawyer who tells me what says yes to me and who has my back is Todd. And like someone's like, Todd's your divorce attorney. Like, and he fired. And this is actually a very true reported story.
I know who Alex Spiros.
He fired every single lawyer and made Todd the GC of Tesla, who was probably actually one of the better GCs and lasted longer than like the parade. He's had 12. GCs of Tesla in 12 years. Some of them have lasted as much as 2 months. So
yeah, that's fascinating. So Alex Spiro is a celebrity lawyer.
Yes.
He, like, represents GC.
Yes, I thought
and,
it was Alex. I couldn't.
Robert Kraft.
I just like was like blanking on the front first name, but
Alex. He's like a high profile litigator.
Yeah, he doesn't know anything about
But he doesn't have an ideology about this.
No. I mean, there just isn't anyone that would work for Musk that has an ideology about this. I think.
Well, I mean, you could imagine someone has a congruent ideology, I guess. I mean, you mentioned that they're engineers. So, like, you could imagine someone coming from that universe, but I just don't know who it is, if there's an advisor of some sort. But after the acquisition gets forced through, he says, "I'm going to fire everybody," and then says something like, "What is the current position?" I've got some like macro questions in a second, but like, where are we? It's Tuesday, November 1st. Like, where are we in the, like, he already fired some people.
He fired the C-suite. Yeah.
The C-suite, yeah.
That was.
And then said it was for cause.
Yeah, that is like, it is Matt Levine.
He's going to lose that litigation. I don't know, yeah.
Matt Levine's write-up of this, of his newsletter, if you haven't read it, is just art. Oh. He was like, this is the most absurd for cause thing. And he just keeps wasting the money of like all of the, of the company to litigate something like this. Anyways, whatever.
Matt Levine is a national treasure. I think we can all agree.
I know. It's just like, unbelievable. He's so good.
Unbelievable. It's like Matt Levine does to business coverage what Joe Nocasella used to do for dance coverage, which is something I was fundamentally not what I do or not my, but like, I was like, for their years, I was like fascinated by modern dance because Joe Nocasella was such a good writer. And I can't make it through a whole modern dance performance without completely losing it or falling asleep. but I read all about it because she was such a good writer. Matt Levine, I'm like, I never have been more fascinated by GameStop. I just like, amazing.
I
anyway,
know. Yeah. No, I completely agree. He has like a Matt to BB like voice. And then he has, anyways, he's just excellent.
The best.
But
he's basically a law professor, by the way. Like, it's like basically the vibe. It's like,
it's very much the vibe.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's.
Yeah. Law school.
Yeah.
Woo.
Yeah.
Anyway. He's fired the C-suite and has he made any policy changes yet? I mean, other than maybe less capacity.
No, I think that, and this is actually, this is like the thing that I am the most terrified of, which is that he turns things over to Automat. He gets rid of, everyone has said, this has been reported multiple times, that the most of the cuts are going to immediately come from the trust and safety teams, which are the teams that do all of the mitigation do a lot of the content moderation. So I think that that's bad. I mean, I think that that's terrifying heading into midterms. Like, I feel like Brazil's election got in just under the radar, just under the buzzer. And we had no idea when he was going to do these layoffs. It looked like he was going to maybe do them last Friday. And then there were bonuses that were supposed to come out today. And so it looked like he might have been trying to get them in yesterday. Anyways, they're all going to come from, most of them are going to come from trust and safety, which will mean that he relies more on kind of automated takedowns and automated kind of, like classifiers to do content moderation. I think that generally speaking, people don't like that type of content moderation. It is very bad. It is very bad for your high profile users. This is like, it kind of creates a lot of problems. And so I don't know. I don't know when the layoffs are going to happen, but it's a certainty. I don't know who could restrain him. He seems like,
yeah, so he said something. He said that he was going to not do anything until he created a content moderation council. And you joked, it was like the Joker sending the Batman signal, which I thought was an amazing tweet. but the thing I wonder is like, so it was obviously the reason that was a joke was because it was in contrast to the heavily legalized Facebook oversight board about which you are the world's expert. And it's like, seriously, I've been doing research into myself. There's like two people who write good papers about this, and you're one of them. So it's you're one of the, you know, it's a I'm not exaggerating in any way, shape, or form. But if we were to be generous to this tweet, what I would say about it was that it was an effort to not do a legalized version of, kind of heavily legalized version of it, but rather to do a more political one, which is that you're going to create a council of elders that chooses things not in a precedent-bound, right opinion sort of way, the way the oversight board does, but a like wisdom of the elders sort of way. Is that a plausible version of it? And if so, would that be bad or good or what?
I think that's 100% plausible version of it. I think that like actually how Facebook did their process, even having like being, I had no NDA. That was part of what I negotiated for and like was just put everything on tape. And so like having a transparent process, whether or not like, you know, I wasn't like in there 100% of the time. There were tons of decisions that got made that I didn't observe, but like, listen, that was actually, there was a process around the creation of it and it was a very thoughtful thing. And like a lot of people push back on it being this like fantasy type thing or this Potemkin village. And like, you know, there's probably to an extent, courts are always like a little bit like that. I think one of the worst versions of what it could have ended up being, and it hasn't ended up being any of those things, by the way, I think actually people, it has like managed to gain a lot of international respect and have like a pretty serious engagement with the issues and the ideas in ways that even I am pleasantly surprised by. Nothing, like, do I expect that Musk is going to do something like that, spend a year and a half building out like and giving $300 million to a project that like, yeah. No.
I definitely don't think he's going to do that. My question is a little different, which is like, to what extent, let's say what he does is create on top of the algorithmic thing, you just have like 15 people Elon Musk thinks are wise.
Yeah.
Making the decision on the highest profile. And this is like not that distinct from the pre-oversight board, where it's like Mark Zuckerberg and his advisors making these decisions. But so here he's going to like partially farm that decision-making out to a committee of which he is the chair of. Is that like, do you think that that's the vision? It's like, it's going to be Elon Musk and Peter Thiel.
Yes.
And like, so it's just going to be like a council of elders.
Yeah. And I mean, if you think it's not going to be, I mean, one of the things that I actually really loved about this all going to court was seeing the tweets, because we were talking before about this myth of like the tech genius and the halo effect, but like the tweets are like an eye movement study versus self-reporting, right? Like there is just kind of like, there is so much like truth when you're not, you don't think you're being surveilled and like what you say and how you conduct yourself. And we saw who he wasn't talking to and the people who tried to have reasonable intervention on him. And then we saw the asshats that kind of came in and stroked his ego and like said a bunch of jargony crap, and which was jargony and had like nothing to do with either the business model of Twitter as it exists or good speech governance. And I think that that's exactly what you'll see with an oversight board for Twitter. That is like, you will see more of that. There's nothing to restrain him from doing that. And so that's like essentially like, that's exactly what will happen.
Yeah. So the basic idea is that what we're going to expect to see is that he's going to appoint, you think, a board of 15 people to decide whether Donald Trump can come back on the platform. And then the rest is going to be done through like algorithmic process that encodes certain things, I assume, but you know, necessarily.
So really small point though, too, who's going to be on that board, David? Like this is the other thing, like the Facebook oversight board, those people staked, like part of why it was good was like a bunch of people staked their reputations on taking Facebook to task. And they had really strong reputations from like Nobel Prize winners to former prime ministers of like, who wants to touch Elon Musk that has a serious reputation? And I mean this really seriously. He's toxic sludge. And he's like, I mean, like people, I know a lot of people that worked for him and all of them, like, it's not like, they're like, I wish he didn't know my name is like literally what people say to me.
Yeah. On the other hand, I mean, he is, also, you know, the richest man in the world and is also like, first of all, there's a lot of people who are willing to do a lot for money. And so,
yeah, I mean, I am always kind of a little bit guileless and like that and like, yeah, and that, but.
Yeah. But the other thing is that like, he's an unbelievably impressive person too, right?
Yeah.
I would have said that relative to, this is pre the Twitter thing, but like relative to your ordinary member of the intelligence, I was like relatively pro Musk. I think he's like a good for the world net net, right? So like electric cars are good for the world, net net. I think space is cool. Like, I think that that's a, like, we're getting people, the investors to pay, like, I don't know, it seems interesting. It's like the kind of risks we want entrepreneurs taking, and if they are profitable, that's exciting. It's like, if a we have a world of low growth, he's a pretty exciting figure for his like wild risk.
Yes, yes.
And like, and that's all exciting. The thing that is, it's not clear to me that like, that, I mean, one of the concerns I'd have about Musk is exactly the inverse of that, which is like, I saw that some tweets, there's some irony that the person most likely to give us flying cars is now giving us 140 characters.
It's like, amazing. It's actually like, it's not an engineering product. That's like the other weird thing. It's not a product you put like more science into, and you like, I mean, like one of the, like to your SpaceX point, the innovation in rockets is like fascinating, and people had stalled for years, like, and years, right? And so like, you're completely correct. Like, this has actually been like having kind of like a capitalist model be freed to solve some of these problems has actually been very good for the problem solving. But that is not like the problem with Twitter, and that is not the solution with Twitter, and like that is not like what an intervention is going to do for Twitter. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and also a waste if you take the positive.
It's like smashing like something really kind of nice and then just being like, yeah, oh, that was fun. Yeah. Like,
yeah. So the other question is like, is it not an engineering problem? So this is one, like, maybe another way of saying it is like, is the question that Twitter needs to solve fundamentally a question of speech regulation at the level of like banning, or is it alternately like, are there things Twitter could do to make the product better, more useful, less awful? I mean, it's like you mentioned the mute button, which is like, I like is like the solution, I mean, other than having the iron will never look at your mentions. Which, by the way, if they had a tool that said you literally couldn't look at your mentions, now we're cooking with gas. But like, are there like, I mean, seriously, that's what everyone needs. Just don't ever look at your mentions. It's fine. Your life will be fine. I would say a separate concern. It's amazing to me, people who are like me who are like very weak Twitter, you know, several thousand users, but not like follower, but not like. Whatever, like even we can't deal with not looking at our mentions. Never mind people. Anyway, separate. But the can they improve the product? Is that one thing that if Elon Musk calls you on the telephone and after say you've described him as toxic sludge, he's like, I like that kind of moxie, kid, and says, you're like, fuck you, man. No, I don't know what to say. But if you ask, like, what should I do with the products other than, let's say I'm committed to not doing the content moderate. What would you suggest? Is there anything to be done with the product?
So this is a great question, like how you're framing this, because like, I actually think this is exactly the misunderstanding that he's like, not like, there is no mute button to solve the problem of whether or not we decide to keep Donald Trump on a platform. That is not an engineering problem. It is a political problem. It is a philosophical problem. It has like, it just doesn't cash out in an engineering solution or an efficiency solution. It is not like, it is a problem of democracy, and it is about the values of democracy that like fundamentally doesn't speak to just like consumer preference or efficiency or better tools. Like,
but it also seems to be a business problem too, because it's like not Donald Trump, but Milo or whatever.
If you
like
want to
driving people off the platform. Yeah.
Right. That is exactly right. And like Alex Jones or like other types of things. And so like, these are so like, and like those political problems come at different places. Like the New York, so like one of the things that, you know, that I thought like, you know, this is why the question of like the New York Post, like Twitter not disseminating the New York Hunter Biden New York Post story was so interesting, because it wasn't about the speaker. It wasn't about some type of, it was about some type of supposed misinformation from a fairly legitimate, like newspaper.
A disaster, right? That was it. We look back at that.
Everyone loved that while it was happening. And I think I was like, myself and Jack Balkin were like some of the few people who were like, that is terrifying. Like, do not, like, you know, like,
yeah,
you know.
That was, I mean, obviously people make mistakes and, you know, we can't, whatever. But like, it does seem, looking backwards, that like that was a, like a real terrible misstep.
But do you see how like those are all the problems that we're talking about? Those are the problems that Elon is concerned with, and those do not have engineering problems. What would you have done differently except just left it up and let the political consequences happen, or done what they did, which was to slow it down and or like ban it? And so these were like, I mean, those are not, and again, they're just not engineering problems. And so like, it's not that there aren't ways, like he could make it a subscriber model. We haven't talked about that. This might be the new future of like, to go to Kevin Roos's point, like the new future of like migrating things into subscriber models more. And like, I mean,
does Twitter even make any sense as a subscriber
not
model?
Not really.
I don't even understand it.
No,
the whole point is broadcasting to the world.
Well, this is
like,
again,
it's like everyone's writes their own newspaper.
Remember when I kind of was saying at the beginning that like, it's all about kind of the model of the non-walled garden versus a walled garden versus the type of content, like the type of product that you're selling? Yes, this all goes back to that. Like there's essentially like the value of Twitter is like, which is why he's doing weird stuff, like trying to charge you for features, like a blue check mark, and not talking necessarily about a pure subscriber model, because it's just like, because it does, the subscriber model is an incoherent response.
But it also seems it would not serve the political end. If the point is, I want people to listen to the Babylon Bee and be confronted by it.
Exactly.
A subscriber model does not solve that,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Like, and in fact, there's a really great, the other thing is there's a lot of studies on this stuff. So there was a great paper out of Wharton a couple of months ago that basically tested content moderation and subscriber versus advertiser revenue models, and which was better and which people ranked as better. Subscriber models are smaller. They're localized communities to kind of like, as a Robert Post would kind of say, like their community set the norms and the norms like, and so they're self-policing. And so there is just kind of this like, you don't need to do as much content moderation, and the group is usually more cohesive as a single kind of entity of like-minded people. So like the New York Times does content moderation for people that subscribe to the New York Times. That is a type of person, and it is easier. It's a more homogenous like group to like to moderate on. That is not Twitter.
Yeah, right. They're all Upper West Side Yentas, basically. It's the whole population of readership. They all live in my neighborhood. It's like, great.
No, that's exactly
the last print subscribers in America.
But you kind of see, right? That like the content moderation, a subscriber base for some, that is what a subscriber base looks like. And like, of course, like anyways, my point is basically like an advertising based model, you have to try to hit some perfect mean to drive in like of like the whole, to try to keep people engaged. And so it drives more content moderation, not less. And so it's actually, I don't know, maybe he'll try. Like, I don't know how work.
That's my last question. I mean, are the structural forces driving towards content moderation so strong that anyone who doesn't want to lose their shirt in this business or lose other people's shirts in this business are effectively going to be, even the richest man in the world, will be forced by the kind of tectonic plates of this type of thing into a somewhat similar pose? Or is it possible that there are going to be a different set of there is a Wild West or halfway Wild West, not a hellscape, but a Wild West version of Twitter that is somewhat sustainable? Like if you're predicting the future, like is there like, could he succeed in his ends self-defined, or is it impossible?
I think that he's not going to succeed in his ends, and I think that he'll be constrained by the business needs of the platform. Like, I think that at the end of the day, someone, like I said at the top, that like basically he was like, he just doesn't really care about, like, if he cares about anything, he doesn't want to lose other people's money. And that might actually be the forcing function that we need to like not trash the platform and kind of start over. But like, if he's smart, he'll beta test things. He'll turn off features for certain audiences and test type of stuff and see how markets react. And like, you know, but he's just like in a very different business, and it makes no sense that he's firing the people that know the business the best and like trying to bring in new talent that doesn't. And it's not like, it just doesn't, like, there's a whole bunch of stuff that just doesn't quite cohesively fit together. So it's unclear how long the growing pains will last, and you know what it'll look like on the other side. But I don't think it'll completely change. I think it will get worse and better and worse, and it's also going to be very unpleasant. I can't believe that he wants to do this. So that's this other part of that, you know.
Well, while it may be unpleasant for him, it was extremely pleasant for me to get a chance to talk to Kate Kladick about this. So thank you so much, Kate. This was so fun.
It was really fun. It's like, yeah,
this is like it's like such a great privilege. I mean, I letting everyone in on the fact that I can now ask the best people in the world to explain things to me. And so I very much appreciate
it. Yeah,
this was really
fun. I would have like done this. I would have done this even if we weren't recording a podcast. So this is great.
I mean, we may well.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, terrific. Thank you so much, Kate.
Bye.